Chair has, I was unexpectedly required to stay in Portland or be in Portland for a while. She's going to arrive about 9 o'clock. She's asked that we delay and set over the two work sessions on Senate Bill 293 and 284 until she returns. And so we'll begin with the public hearing on 520. Mr. Gribbling? Oh, there you are. Okay. Do we have the sign-up sheet on there?
Sure.
Got a long agenda, so please help us by moving as long as quickly as you can. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 520.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ray Gribbling. I represent U.S. West. I'm here to talk about the treble damage statute, found at ORS 756-185, which was adopted as a portion of the Utility Act of 1911. Introduced at that time by Senator Malarkey as Senate Bill 73, the act conferred upon the Railroad Commission of Oregon the power and jurisdiction to supervise and regulate public utilities. Statute has always allowed a treble damage award and has always required an award of attorney's fees. Statute was modified in 1943 to show that the treble damage and attorney fees liability did not apply in cases of personal injury or property damage. In 1973, it was again modified to cover air carriers in addition to other utilities. The scope of the statute was not addressed until 1979 in Holman versus Pacific Northwest Bell. In the Holman case, the court held that we had violated 757-225, which states in part, no public utility shall charge, demand, collect, or receive a greater or less compensation for any service than is specified in printed rate schedules. In this case, the court awarded treble damages because we had inadvertently billed the customer for service we did not provide. Someone at some time failed to verify our billing records at the time work was being performed. I would submit to the committee that no public utility or any other business has perfect record keeping and billing capability. Even under the most careful procedures, billing errors are bound to occur because people operate the system and people are fallible. It would be arguably proper to require a utility to bear the cost of billing at a rate greater than the filed tariffs allow, but where we are held liable for treble damages merely because, for example, one of our installers handled a work order and put in 3 phones instead of the 4 shown on the work order and neglected to correct the billing department's records, then it seems totally improper to treat those mistakes as anything other than a normal, unavoidable cost of doing business. In general, the statutes which double or treble damages are seen as punitive statutes to deter persons or corporations from violating the law. In the case of such punitive statutes, it's generally necessary to show that the violator intentionally or willfully violated the law. A review of the statutes governing utilities will show that penalties, fines, and forfeitures are provided in every chapter except 758, and that's about 150 pages of things that can go wrong. For instance,
Mr. Gribbling?
Yes.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute, and I see the case you're making, and it makes a whole lot of sense for me. I guess one of the questions I want to ask is, the statute talks about public utilities, railroads, air carriers, motor carriers. why should any of these folks be subject to treble damages for essentially a minor mistake? Because I agree with you. Anytime I've ever seen treble damages, it has been as a punishment for willful or intentional wrongdoing.
Well, that's right, Representative Clark.
Why doesn't your argument apply to everybody else in the statute as well?
Well, originally the bill, Representative Clark, was submitted as a repeal of 756-185, and that would, of course, slop over into the new Chapter 447 Oregon laws dealing with telecommunications utilities. The Senate committee had decided that our case, where we have emerging competition in the telecommunications industry, they felt that the other utilities were not subject to the same type of competition, so okay, they amended the bill.
That's a good answer. Thank you.
Well, to continue, for instance, 756-990 sub 2 states, except where a penalty is otherwise provided by law. Any public utility, railroad, air carrier, motor carrier, or any other person subject to the jurisdiction of the commission shall forfeit a sum of not less than $100 nor more than $10,000 each time that the person violates any statute administered by the commissioner, does any act prohibited or fails to perform any duty enjoined upon the person, fails to obey any lawful requirement or order made by the commissioner, or fails to obey any judgment or decree made by any court upon the application of the commission. Penalties range from a low of $50 to a high of $10,000, from 30 days in the county jail to 5 years in the state pen. In the 81 session, we proposed Senate Bill 438, which amended 756-185 to allow a person to recover treble damages only if that person is injured by a utility's intentional violation of the public utility statutes. The bill passed and currently requires the party seeking damages to prove that the wrong or omission was the result of gross negligence or willful misconduct. It was assumed at the time that these standards afforded some protection against automatic treblings, but in fact these assumptions were short-lived. In 1985, we found ourselves on the short end in Fisher Motors versus Pacific Northwest Bell. In this case, the jury returned a verdict against PNB in the amount of $562,000, which was automatically trebled to $1.7 million. Under the Oregon Treble Damage Statute that applies to grossly negligent service errors by public utilities. We do not take issue in this forum as to the merits of the Fisher Motor case. We did take issue, however, with the automatic trebling of the jury award to the tune of $1.7 million. This is too high a price to be paid for actions that are neither willful or gross. In the 87th session, we proposed House Bill 2757, which would amend the statute to allow the awarding of damages in an amount not to exceed treble to the discretion of the court. It was suggested that the penalty would be left to the whim of a trial court judge. I could take issue with that view, but what is past is past. What is present is the fact that our industry has changed, and what we seek is a level playing field. To summarize, our reasons for seeking this legislation are twofold. First, we wish to update the statutes to more appropriately reflect the changes that have occurred in the telecommunications industry since the original 1911 enactment of the current laws. The initial purpose of imposing automatic treble damages simply does not apply in today's highly competitive marketplace and greatly changed operating conditions for telecommunications utilities.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Minnis.
Yes, Mr. Gribling, you've submitted your testimony in writing, as I understand.
Yes, I did.
And I would suggest, if it's the permission of the chair, that we go into work session rather than keep going, just simply because we have 17 bills up, and I think there's a consensus.
That's fine with me, Representative Minnis.
Thank you. There are no other witnesses signed up on this bill, so we'll be in work session.
Chairman, move the bill to the full committee of the due pass
recommendation. Representative Minnis has moved the bill to full committee of the due pass recommendation. I just want to make one comment on the bill, because Mr. Gribling did submit very good written testimony on this. And towards the end, in fact, on your last page, I don't know that you've gotten to this yet, you really get to the guts of what I think this bill is about. There's a double standard in the courts as far as U.S. West is concerned, that you, I understand, and the present law are subject to these treble damage awards, but your competitors are not.
That's true.
And as I understood, when we deregulated, we being the United States of America, deregulated the phone industry, telecommunications industry, this is sort of a hangover from the old days. And that the new, basically, we need a level battleground here for the telecommunications customer. And so I think that, as I understood your bill when we talked earlier, that's the real guts of it. And
that's true.
So I don't think that we're doing anything that's inconsistent. In fact, we're really doing something that is consistent. Is that okay?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
one final question. Mr. Gribling, no opposition that you know about to this bill?
None on this side, Representative Clark.
That's fine.
Okay, are there any further questions or comments?
What was the opposition on the other side?
The opposition, Representative Calhoun, came from the Public Utility Commission, who felt that we had taken away the patron's right to take us to court for a violation of the utility statutes. That is not entirely accurate. We have denied no one the right to take us to court under common law for any violation of the statute or any thing that we might be accused of. They suggested that we amend the bill, take out the trebling language, put in punitives, but at the same time they wanted the standards of gross negligence or willful misconduct to apply to punitives. Gross negligence is a lower standard than you find in common law for punitive damages. I couldn't live with that particular proposal that came from the commission, and fortunately the Senate Judiciary Committee agreed with me.
Any further? Okay, nothing further. Clerk will read. We'll call the roll as soon as she gets off the phone.
Would you like me to call the roll, Mr. Chairman?
Why don't we go ahead and call the roll? Thank you.
Superintendent Vaughn?
Yes.
Calhoun?
Yes.
Clark?
Yes.
Minnie?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 520 is sent to full committee with a due pass recommendation. Let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 247. And we have... Shuffle through here. Do you want to be Mr. Marquis? Marquis, is this you? Okay, hold on a second.
Excuse me.
Is there a sign-up sheet, counsel?
It should be.
Ma'am, were you? I think you know what you're signed up. We're going to find the sign-up sheet in a minute, so go ahead and tell us, welcome to the committee, and tell us your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dolores Glennie, representing the Tax Collectors Association. Senate Bill 247 is for collection of delinquent personal property taxes. And it's what it does. It gives us the same right as IRS and Department of Revenue in a continuing garnishment.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Gives the counties the same... Would you state your last statement again?
Glennie.
No, your
and
last
I'm scared.
Statement. Your last statement. About what the bill does.
Oh, it gives us the same continuing garnishment as IRS and DOR.
Okay. Continuing garnishment over wages?
It could be wages or a bank account.
Okay. I'm looking for the bill, and I'm having a hard time finding it, so I'm talking blind.
Can I stop for a minute? I'm shaking so bad.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
That's all right. As somebody said once before.
Caffeine.
I don't know why I'm shaking.
Or hot water.
Those of us who, what is it that that Miller said? Those of us who serve with Representative Courtney share your nervousness?
Thank you.
For obvious reasons.
Okay.
Bill Peter's watching.
Thank you.
Don't worry, we're not going to give you a hard time on this bill.
I'm hoping not. I am not real familiar with garnishments. This is where I have a problem.
I know that the Senate passes 27-3, and there doesn't appear to be anybody in opposition. And
that's right, Representative Mannix. We found the sign-up sheet, and the reason that it wasn't at hand is no one had signed up on the bill. So I don't think so.
I had signed up on it the other day.
Just had this one, so there isn't.
Can we move into work session?
Mr. Chair, I think there are people here who have some problems with the bill.
Well, let's do you have any... Excuse me, Representative.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to try to keep control of this hearing. Did you have anything further you wanted
no,
to
No, I don't.
Thank you.
Could I ask
much.
One question? Quickly?
Representative Minnis has a question.
I didn't catch who you represent.
The tax collectors, county tax collectors.
County tax collectors. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 247, Mr. Marquis?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I just wanted to point out the next bill on your list today, 2666, deals with this same subject, continuing garnishment. You may want to look at the two of them together. 247 sets out a continuing garnishment for counties, debts owed to counties, where an employer is garnished or where an employee is garnished on an employer garnishment. whereby the garnishment would run forever.
Would you explain how it works now?
What is existing law?
We're going to a continuing garnishment, but I guess now we have a discontinuing garnishment. How does it work now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, under present law, when a judgment is obtained, the judgment creditor issues a writ of garnishment to a bank, against a bank account, or some other financial institution, or may issue a writ of garnishment to an employer against wages. That garnishment is good for any wages due and owing on the day that it is served only. So a bill collector generally tries to time the serving of that to coincide with a payday. If a person is paid every Friday, you simply have to serve a writ of garnishment every Friday or you don't get any money.
Okay, Representative Park.
Mr. Markey, my question is, are we creating a new right of garnishment on behalf of the county, or are we simply saying that the right of garnishment of a county, which county already has, is going to be turned into a continuing?
They already have the right of garnishment, Representative Clark. It's simply, under this bill, it would continue until the debt is paid. Presently, the Department of Revenue has that right, and Child Support has, Support Enforcement Division, Department of Justice, has that right. They are the only two in Oregon, other than IRS under federal law. So this would run until the debt is paid. Under the other bill, it is a 60-day limit for everybody. So.
Okay. Any further questions of Mr. Markey?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Calhoun.
You know, it just seems nonsensical, the current garnishment system. Or maybe, is there a rationale behind the current system?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Calhoun, your point is well taken, and that's why we have brought the next bill on the agenda to you. Because
we can get into that in the next bill. Anything further, Mr. Markey?
No, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else like to testify on this bill,
Mr. Chair?
We're out of public hearing into work session.
What I was going to say is perhaps we could wait to move into work session on 247. I have some questions about this. The existing garnishment process does not make much sense, as Representative Calhoun mentioned. But I'm reluctant to start creating special rights among specific plaintiffs until we see the larger issue. So maybe we could have our hearing on the other one first.
I think that's a good suggestion. So I'll close this work session with the understanding we're going to resume that and open the public hearing on House Bill 2666. Mr. Markey, let's talk about this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Jim Markey, representing Oregon Collectors Association. I've brought Ken Ryder, the attorney for our association, with me to help me explain this bill. And to my left is Terry Rogers with Legal Aid, who we've worked on with the bill. This bill, as I just explained in reference to Senate Bill 247, current law, you serve a writ of garnishment, it's good for the day that it gets served. In many other states, they have what is known as a continuing garnishment, in effect, whereby a garnishment against wages would continue, in some cases, till the debt's paid, in some cases, for a shorter time period. We modeled this bill after the Colorado law, and it simply puts into effect a continuing garnishment on wages only, and we didn't go into continuing garnishment against bank accounts. We don't think that makes much sense. Once you garnish a bank account, the person is not going to put more money in the bank account while you have a continuing garnishment in effect. So we didn't deal with that issue. The garnishment, once served, would served against the employer and would be good for wages owing on that day and for future wages due for the next 60 days. There are amendments which we have submitted, the -2 amendments, and these were amendments which were worked out with Legal Aid. They do several things, and I believe that Mr. Ryder can explain those in detail, but there were, on page 1 in section 3, it was a little bit unclear as to how the priority of a subsequently served garnishment would take place. We've allowed for a plaintiff to serve one garnishment, which would be good for 60 days, and if another were served during that 60-day period, the employer would send a notice back to the plaintiff saying that there was one already in effect, so that there would never be two in effect on the same employee at the same time. The person who served the second one then would have priority, and his garnishment would take effect at the end of the 60 days, as I understand the amendments. The plaintiff who served the first garnishment would be prohibited from filing a second garnishment any time during the second or during the 60-day period on the same employer against the same defendant. Legal Aid had wanted some language in this bill which would notify the employer that they could not lawfully discharge the debtor from employment as a result of the garnishment, and we've inserted that in this in the form that goes out to the employer, the writ itself. And on the writ, they wanted us to, as plaintiffs, to sign where we sign the agreement to have the notice that inserting items and amounts not lawfully subject to collection by garnishment may result in liability to the debtor for wrongful execution. We don't have any problem with those amendments, and that's just fine. I believe that we're in agreement. There was a small problem with this bill in that Legal Aid did want these same notice requirements in the other garnishment forms, which, because we would have a continuing garnishment now if you pass this bill for employer-type garnishments, there would still be the one-time garnishment against banks in existence, and with respect to that garnishment, you have a clerk-issued garnishment form and an attorney-issued garnishment form. This bill does not deal with those two forms, but Legal Aid would like to have those same notice requirements in the forms for those other kinds of garnishment, those other two forms. We have absolutely no problem with that. We didn't have LC draft them originally because we were, House Bill 2930 was just passing out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The final amendments were not written yet, and we were concerned that there may be a conflict, and the timing was just wrong, so they're not in these amendments, but if you want to add them, they're just fine with us. We don't care. It's a simple conceptual thing to do as long as it conforms with 2930. So I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I believe Mr. Ryder can go through the bill in more detail if you want.
Okay. On that warning language, inserting items and amounts not lawfully subject to collection by garnishment may result in liability to the debtor for wrongful execution. Would it clarify, I don't want to add a lot of language here, but it's liability of the creditor to the debtor, but are we adding too much there? Is that obvious to the person who's filling out the form?
It's Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, it's not my language. If you want to add of the creditors, that's fine with me.
Of course, it might be someone else who inserts the items, too.
Yeah. If you're going to add language, you don't want to say of the creditor, probably.
That's because that's not the term of art we're using here anyway.
Yeah, the term of art that is used in the garnishment law is plaintiff. That's simply because in 1979 when this bill was, when the original garnishment bill was drafted, somebody used plaintiff and defendant instead of judgment creditor and judgment defendant. So it's their judgment debtor. So that mistake has been carried forward, and you may want to say.
How about just strike that?
Representative Clark.
My only question is, if we have this bill as broad as it is, do we need 247?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we have been somewhat concerned about various individuals coming in wanting a continuing garnishment. This concern started when IRS has always had a continuing garnishment and levy, which lasted until the debt is paid, and I can understand that, I guess. Support Enforcement Division came in and got one for them. Department of Revenue got one for them. Now the counties want one. And this continues every session where someone wants a continuing garnishment that runs until the debt is paid. Obviously, if you own a collection agency, that puts you at a disadvantage to that entity. And so we have a vested interest in saying, no, that doesn't make sense. But
the only difference is that House Bill 2666 creates a 60-day continuing garnishment.
Yes.
The other one creates a permanent one. If we pass House Bill 2666, then at least the counties will have more than they have now.
Yes.
By 60 days, or by whatever the difference between the wage period and 60 days is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Maddox.
I beg to differ on that. House Bill 2666 relates to garnishments that are issued against any garnishee who is an employer of the judgment debtor. Now it's going to read who is an employer of the defendant. The other bill relates to garnishments generally, and it's not limited to employers. The tax collection garnishment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maddox, I believe that 247, as I read it, is limited to garnishments on employers.
Now I'm looking for the bill.
If you'll read the summary, it says provides that writ of garnishment on employer and issued on behalf of county remains in effect. And
you're
if you
right.
look on,
right.
on line 6 and 7, if the garnishment is on an employer. So it is to an employer. I think that's because, again, a continuing garnishment against a bank account just doesn't make much sense. You know.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Maddox.
Two follow-ups on that. Thanks for correcting me on that. I guess the question then is whether or not the county needs more than 60 days to go after their taxes, or whether or not we ought to be more liberal in regard to House Bill 2666. Unfortunately, the relating clause on Senate Bill 247 is too narrow, or else I'd be tempted to amend our bill, the House bill, into the Senate bill. But theirs relates to garnishment by counties. Well, back to House Bill 2666. What if we took out the words to the debtor in that warning language, because there may be liability elsewhere also, where it says inserting items and amounts not lawfully subject to collection by garnishment may result in liability. You put to the debtor for wrongful execution. There may be liability elsewhere.
It would just say in liability for wrongful execution.
Mr. Chair?
Terry, do you want to give us your testimony?
And I'll comment on that. Terry Rogers.
Yeah, I know we're in a public hearing stage, so if we can just kind of make these notes, and when we get into work session, we'll be able to start changing and mixing and matching. Go ahead.
Terry Rogers, representing low-income people for Multnomah County Legal Aid. We are not opposed to the bill with the amendments that have been worked out with Mr. Markey and Mr. Ryder. We would like to see the notices also put in the regular garnishment writs, and as Mr. Markey said, legislative counsel indicated that would take conflict amendments in 2930, and I think 2930 is probably due to be printed any day, and that should not be a problem. In response to Mr. Maddox, Representative Maddox's suggestion, I think that that will actually make the language clearer. I would have no objection to eliminating to the debtor.
Questions of Ms. Rogers? Thank you. Mr. Ryder, did you want to testify?
I just wanted to mention one thing. My name is Kenneth R. Ryder, and I'm the attorney for the Oregon Collectors Association. This is really a suggested amendment to the amendment, and I'm looking at dash 2, and on line 15, we wanted to insert the word individual after any. So it would read...
Would you give me the page?
Sorry. It's page 1 of the proposed amendment, line 15. After the word any, we wanted to insert the word individual.
After the word any individual defendant or any individual writ?
Any individual defendant.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. There are two anys. You're right. So it would read, no plaintiff may issue more than one writ of garnishment against the earnings of any individual defendant during the term of the lien created by any writ of garnishment previously issued and served by that plaintiff. The reason we wanted to do that is we didn't want to allow any single plaintiff to tack on continuing writs of garnishments on top of what they had already issued. In other words, the way that this bill is currently phrased, if creditor 1 issues a continuing writ of garnishment against employer on April 1, and then creditor number 2 comes along and issues a 60-day writ of garnishment on April 2. The way that that's going to work is that the garnishee will honor creditor number 1 for the first 60 days, and then creditor number 2 will come along at the expiration of the 60 days and have his or her writ honored. We didn't want to allow any plaintiff to come along on April 1, issue one 60-day writ of garnishment, and on April 2 have that same plaintiff issue another writ of garnishment, so in essence, they could hit that debtor for 120 days. That did not seem to be fair. So what we wanted to do through this language is prevent a plaintiff from tacking on continuing writs of garnishments or any type of writ of garnishment while that plaintiff had one already in effect against a single or individual defendant. So that's the reason for that amending language.
Any questions, Mr. Ryder?
Mr. Chair, just for point of clarification, where was a word to be inserted again?
Okay, we're on page 1 of the proposed amendments on line 15 after the first any. So it would be the earnings of any individual defendant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Anything further from witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one thing. One of the things that has bothered me consistently about the present garnishment law, and one of the main reasons that I think this bill will be good, is that if you have a debtor out there that's getting paid every Friday and a collector, bill collector, is garnishing his wages every Friday, the first, you're talking $12.50 to serve the writ of garnishment plus a $3 issuance fee, and if out of every month's wages, you've got about $60 of the debtor's wages going just to pay the cost of issuing and serving the writs. And this will eliminate that, and that same money would apply against.
And it's almost better to pay them nothing than to pay them that kind of a fee. And what we'd like to do is increase the fee to a reasonable level. As most of you know, a federal court now pays $35 a day and 25 cents a mile. What we've done is increase the fee to $30 a day and 25 cents a mile. We did do a survey of other states and learned that other states are all over the board as far as the fees that they charge, but this is not something that's out of line even with other states. And we anticipate that probably this fee isn't going to be changed again for probably quite a long time, so we want to get it up to a reasonable level. The problem that we have really encountered in this bill is not so much the amount of the fee, but restricting those fees basically to civil proceedings. Our problem is trying to avoid any fiscal impact on the state, and that occurs where we have criminal proceedings involved, where there are public bodies who are prosecuting, or where public bodies are involved as parties. And I have consulted with the District Attorney's Association and with the Attorney General's Office, trying to work out something that will avoid that fiscal impact. And what we have now is a bill that specifically excludes criminal proceedings, proceedings prosecuted by a public body, and proceedings where the public body is a party. For those proceedings, we will retain the current level of $8 or 8 cents a mile and $5 a day. We think there's a good reason for having the disparate between the two systems based on the fact that in the criminal area, you're dealing with public health and safety. And there's a higher duty of citizenship, we think, for people to appear and testify at a lower fee. We also wanted to avoid the situation where you have witnesses called by public bodies.
Representative Minnis?
Yeah, I have a question on a point referencing public bodies and when a public body is involved in a civil suit. Now, as a police officer who investigates traffic accidents, I often am subpoenaed to civil trials. And generally the private attorney will send me a check or cash for $5 or whatever it is, which I turn over to the police bureau. And the police bureau then pays me at the overtime rate according to our union contract for that. What's wrong with including reimbursement where it's where there are costs on the part of the local municipality for overtime or employment-related costs? Why not reimburse at a higher rate than just $5?
That's a point that hasn't been brought up before. I would assume where you are testifying, it is where the state is a party, or you appear
as a
witness.
Well, as a police officer, just have investigated a traffic accident,
okay.
I turn the $5 over to the bureau, and then they turn around and pay me $200 for showing up.
In that case, if it's just a civil proceeding where the state isn't involved, you would receive the higher reimbursement of $30 a day under this bill. I think your question is, should we change the bill so that you would actually receive your overtime pay?
No. I guess what you're saying is that if I investigate the accident, but there's a civil action involving two civil parties, I'm merely a witness and I'm representing a public interest.
If you're merely a witness and the public is not a party or is not prosecuting, you would receive the $30 a day.
Well, the bureau would ultimately should. And that's the point I'm trying to get at, is if they're getting reimbursed at that rate, then that's fine.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, Maddox?
Just as an aside, I'd mention
We have passed through the House a bill that says when the state police officers are subpoenaed in civil actions, that the state police is going to be able to demand $160. Is it $160?
$160, I think.
A day. Because their people are being called in all the time as expert witnesses, as cheap expert witnesses. And the idea was, well, that's the first step, that we'll keep an eye on that and see how that works. But maybe at some point, police officers who are subpoenaed in civil actions, people might be asked to be more precise about when they want them. Of course, that's not the bill in front of us.
Thank you, Representative Maddox. Do the witnesses have further testimony?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Much.
Right. I like that.
Bell.
Go back and ask you one more time. Do you have further testimony? Okay, is there anyone else who'd like to testify on this bill? Hearing none, we're in work session.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to 273 to the full committee. But they do pass a recommendation.
Representative Minnis has moved Senate Bill 273 to the full committee with a do pass recommendation. Representative Calhoun?
I don't think I buy the disparity argument.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix?
I happen to agree, Representative Calhoun. I'll be blunt about this. I have a feeling that what happened with this is the reason why the public bodies are exempt is because we don't want this bill to go to Ways and Means where it will die. And what we need to do is have a separate effort to skirt through the Ways and Means process. And I can imagine next session we're going to come in and say, darn it, we're doing this in civil cases. Why aren't we doing it in criminal cases? And public bodies should be included, and let's send this to Ways and Means and tell them to fund this baby.
I think what we're doing here is eating a gorilla a bite at a time.
There we go.
Or an elephant.
Or an elephant.
Mr. Chairman.
So small and tough, you can't chew them. Is there anything further on the bill? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Bob?
Yes.
Calhoun?
I'll vote aye, but only for purposes of moving it through the full committee.
Manning?
Aye.
Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Evanson?
Aye, and Senate Bill 273 is passed and sent to the committee with a due-pass recommendation. Okay, next up, Senate Bill 697. Senator Kennemer? Welcome.
Thank you.
I understand you're having a press conference.
Yes.
About this bill in the committee and what a great work we're doing.
It must be the import of this bill.
Where's the TV camera?
Wait till you see the amendments.
We're broadcasting live from the Capitol.
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Senator Bill Kennemer, District 12. Regarding Senate Bill 697, this is a little bill about the uninsured motorist problem. And it seems like every time I meet with my constituents, just about somebody brings this up. This last interim, I served on the task force on insurance, and one of those thorny problems that we spent some time on and had trouble coming up with solutions for is the uninsured motorist. Department of Motor Vehicle estimates that about 17% of our motorists in our vehicles in Oregon are uninsured, and in 40% of the accidents in Oregon, an uninsured motorist is involved. Not always the cause, but involved. This results in an estimated cost of about $57 million. It's a frustrating problem. It's not easily solved, and this bill doesn't solve the problem, but I hope it moves in the right direction and tries to deal with at least one segment. From my perspective, one of the problems with the uninsured motorist is that there's a problem about lack of responsibility, and I tried to look at how could one look at instilling a better sense of responsibility. Something that we do in Clackamas County and indeed around the state is have public service as one of the punishments. This has become increasingly popular, particularly for driving under the influence. And I think as I've talked to some of these people, it works pretty well. Generally, there are a couple of coordinators who are staffers, and then volunteers actually supervise the work, which keeps the cost of this program very small. Obviously, we don't have the jail space to put these people in there, and besides that, I don't think jail is the correct rehabilitative measure in these regards anyhow. And these people spend a little time doing public service. They often have a better sense about what their social responsibility is, and I think also want to avoid it in the future. We also felt that part of the problem, one of the reasons people drive uninsured is that they don't have money. So for the most part, penalties are not the way to go. Financial penalties are not the way to go. In looking at this, originally the bill was much stronger, and it's been moderated to suggest allowing up to 150 hours community service. There are a couple of important points in that regard. We spent quite a bit of time in the Senate Judiciary Committee discussing the impact of the Brown versus Multnomah County decision, which has to do with indigent defense. And the concern was that the penalty must not be high enough to create indigent defense, which was where it was initially. So it was determined that 150 hours should place it below that threshold. Then the second problem related to that is the U.S. Constitution forbids the creation of servitude as a punishment. So that's why you have the permissive language. You cannot require someone to do public service. You may offer it as one of the alternatives, and they may select it. So that's why the permissive language. Also, it was decided by the Senate Judiciary to move driving uninsured from a Class B traffic offense infraction to a Class A, which does incidentally raise the fine to $500. But again, like I said at the beginning, mostly we're not collecting those, so that's not an issue anyhow.
Any questions, Senator Kanemer?
Yeah,
Minutes.
Senator, I think you sat on the Interim Insurance Committee, as did I, and is this the only bill coming through dealing with the insurance problem? Because this seems like pablum to me.
We did just recently pass out another bill which sets up another interim task force specifically on uninsured motorists. Beyond that, Representative Calori has with driving under the influence.
Right.
Excuse me. I think that this is just about it. And unfortunately, it's not very much, but it does at least remind judges that they have an option here. And I'm hopeful that maybe that will encourage them. I'm very frustrated about this problem. You know, I examined a number of other things. I did explore the idea of vehicle forfeiture.
And so did we.
Yes. Yes, and so have you. And I haven't seen that bill progress. It gets a bit complicated. I also had proposed a modest gas tax, which would have merely required a constitutional amendment and a few other things. I found that was less than a popular way to approach this problem. And it's interesting. It's a terrible problem. Everybody agrees it's a problem. But when it comes to solving it, because I thought for somewhere around 1 to 2 cents per gallon, which really would be less probably than the uninsured motorist that you're paying unless you drive a lot of miles and consume a lot of gas, we could provide uninsured motorists for all of us through a gas tax. And at least those who drive would be helping to pay that cost. Now, that's not full-blown insurance, because that would be probably 50 to 60 cents a gallon, which would be extraordinarily expensive.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
thank you for that.
I've considered seizing their tires as evidence until their trial. I do have a serious question. I think this is a very, very serious problem, and again, it's a perplexing one. But one of the amendments that I think I'm going to be offering to the subcommittee is a requirement that a police officer shall issue a citation to a person that they find in violation of driving uninsured. And I'd almost like to see a minimum fine there, so that the court's not capable of just saying, okay, fine, you're guilty, but go away, because this is a nuisance kind of a thing. And I think, at least in Multnomah County Traffic Court, it's more of a pain in the batushki for the judges than anything else, but it's a serious enough problem, I think, warrants serious considerations. I don't know how you would react to a mandatory requirement that police officers, law enforcement officers, are required to issue citations.
Representative Menace, I'm not sure how easy it will be for them to verify that and what the
it
cost implications.
It isn't easy now because
yeah.
The insurance companies don't issue uniformly the same kind of ID cards.
But one of the other notions that was considered and will be considered, I assume, by the interim group, assuming it passes, is the idea that is used in a couple of other states where you create stickers like the safety stickers that are present in some states.
The state of Washington uses this.
There would be an insurance sticker as well.
Right.
But it didn't seem like there was enough time to put that into a workable form. I would not object to that as long as it does not increase the costs of this thing and create a financial impact that will not work.
Madam Chair, since Indigent Defense seems to be this legislature's boogeyman, I think the $500 fine or a minimum fine trend should be the direction we begin to go in, that that money begin to go into Indigent Defense. And I guess it saddens me that we sat through the entire interim going over insurance and uninsured motorists, and then this is the result of what we've got. I think that's pretty sad.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Manning.
How would you feel about an amendment that would add to the sanctions provision the following phrase, and shall be denied access to the courts of this state for purposes of bringing any civil action relating to injuries sustained during any act of driving uninsured, which was the basis for the conviction?
Well, you know, personally...
Do you want to leave it with that, Senator, or do you want to further explain how you feel about that amendment?
Yeah. Maybe that's a good point to leave it. I don't think that one's going to pass, but there are a lot of us who do feel strongly about it. I had another proposal that my legislative aide always gets upset about. It has to do with lynching, but but that was not considered to be a wise amendment to add either.
Senator, I don't know if you were here when Representative Edmondson talked about eating a gorilla one bite at a time. Maybe this is not the time to take two bites out of a gorilla.
I would agree with that, Representative.
To eat the whole thing.
Yeah. I wish that we could take the whole gorilla on. I don't think so, and that's, you know, it's unfortunate. It is a very small bite, but at least it's a bite.
Representative.
Well, as I see it, these people are probably punished pretty handily currently, because when they get conviction for driving uninsured, largely that's because the person probably can't afford insurance, and then when they go to get insurance from the insurance company, you got that driving uninsured, and despite the fact that it has nothing whatsoever to do with you being a negligent driver or a bad risk, we're going to crank your rates up three times because of that. And I was wondering, given the relating clause of this bill, how you would feel about a separate section of this bill with some language to ensure that insurance companies can't consider driving uninsured when they're figuring rates or when they're figuring whether or not to provide someone with insurance.
Representative Calhoun, you bring up an excellent point, and I had surfaced an idea like that, and unfortunately I think that you'll find that that would probably tube this measure again because it becomes so controversial with. But I agree, we have a system that creates a disincentive. You know, my case happened to be I had a constituent who was newly divorced with two children. She had a 74 Pinto. And as she got herself straightened out financially, she wanted to go back and buy insurance. She'd been driving for about 6 months without insurance. She'd been paying $320 or $40 a year. She went back and they wanted triple that. And I was eventually able to intervene and find an agent who would be proactive for her and get her in at a lower rate. But you're right, that's one of the big problems we have, is that just driving uninsured automatically boosts you out of a preferred category. And so we have a disincentive built into the system. I would like to correct that. I think it would probably be appropriate in a separate bill.
Representative Calhoun.
Was that because the person had been convicted of driving uninsured or just because they didn't have insurance?
One of the questions that you're asked typically is, who was your previous insurer? And generally, have you been in, you know, and often there's a question about whether you've had continuous insurance. And so in the course of answering those questions, you usually indict yourself. She did not have any accidents or any convictions or any driving offenses during that time.
I'm for the senator that this committee is certainly not afraid of enacting or attempting to enact legislation that ultimately gets tubed elsewhere.
Yes.
I've objected to a lot of it. So.
Are there further questions for Senator Kinnemer? Representative Manis.
No, I was just going to ask if we were going to go into work session.
Yes, Representative Manis, we are going to go into work session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
We're in work session on Senate Bill 697, Representative Mannix.
Madam Chair, despite my temptation to play games, it's too late in the session to do that, and I move Senate Bill 697 without amendment to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discretion being the soul of valor.
Well, he has a constitutional problem as well, probably.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Is there a discussion on the motion?
I would move to amend Representative Mannix's motion.
Uh-oh. You have a student, Representative Mannix. Yes, Representative
What do we do? He's going to go the other way.
Calhoun's amending.
Yeah, I've got my scroll over here. I've been working on this. No, the on the Section 6, which is our new section of this bill, I'm tempted to put a section in that would say that they're allowed to either do the community service or the fine, much as we did with the minor in possession of tobacco. And the reason for that is that these people are probably in the system in the first place because they don't have any money. Otherwise, they'd probably have insurance. So I think 150 hours of community service is quite a strong hammer.
So, Representative Calhoun, are you moving to strike the words "in addition to" or
"I would" from line 22? On line 22, I would strike "in addition to" or "in lieu of any sentence to pay a fine," going into line 23. And then at the end of line 23, after "may," we need the language "be sentenced to pay a fine or may," and it goes into the existing language "be sentenced to perform up to 150 hours of community service work."
I can ask a question. Representative Calhoun, that would mean the judge could give him one or the other, or is it the option of the offender to choose?
That would mean that the judge could sentence him to one or the other. I think that's clear. We could try to get some language to make sure.
Well, I think you might run afoul of that community service being treated as though you were getting a little more than a fine, and therefore treating it more as a crime, and they should get counsel and all this mess. That's why the testimony was that the 150 hours community service was kind of an option you give to the violator. You say, well, you can pay a $500 fine, or if you choose to, you can perform 150 hours community service. Otherwise, you might fall into the trap of having to appoint the guy an attorney.
If
well, perhaps, Representative Calhoun, what we'd like to do is give the option to a judge to sentence to one or the other, which is why my suggestion for your amendment would be that you just that your amendment be to strike the words "in addition to" or, so that the language would be "in lieu of any sentence to pay a fine, a person convicted may be sentenced to perform up to 150 hours of community service work." I think that accomplishes your purpose and takes care, I think, of your issue. It
already
doesn't. I'm sorry. I'm
the chair.
I prefer the chair's language on that amendment.
Representative Mannix.
I was just going to say, if Representative Calhoun prefers your language, then fine, we can just decide it on that basis.
We can just decide it on the basis of that language. Is there further discussion?
I'd like to hear where this has evolved. I mean, the motion is now what?
The motion is to strike the words "in addition to" or from line 22.
Makes the sanctions
the
much.
Purpose is to diminish the available sentencing from both to being one or the other. Is that correct, Representative Calhoun?
Correct, Madam Chair.
I would oppose that.
I understand. Yeah. Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll Clerk will call the roll on the Representative Calhoun amendment to the motion.
Oh.
Calhoun.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Mason.
Aye.
Yannis.
No.
Chair Bowman.
Aye.
Chair.
Motion carries.
I have another motion.
Go ahead.
I want to move that we add a Section 7 to the bill that would state that any fine imposed under this act shall be paid into the State Indigent Defense Fund.
Is there a State Indigent Defense Fund?
Somewhere.
There's the General Fund.
There it is, back of the back sleeve. The Indigent Defense Fund is inside the General
English
Fund.
Testimony here coming.
Mr. Linden.
That's a motion to amend Representative Mannix's motion.
No, this is a new motion. One just passed.
No, we have Representative Mannix's motion before us, which is to send the bill up.
Well,
it's okay, your motion is appropriate. Representative.
Madam Chair, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator, there is no indigent defense fund as such in which you could place dedicated revenues, but Senate Bill 284, which is up this morning as well, would create such a fund for the placement of revenues from recoupment or partial contribution by defendants. So there's nothing now, but there could be something.
I mean, you could say the state general fund to be used solely for the purpose of indigent defense. I think we better start getting a handle on generating some revenues here if we're going to do anything.
Is there a discussion on the motion? I guess.
Hey, remind me to call.
Mr. Linden, let me ask you a question if you don't mind popping up here again. Are fines, the way fines are applied, and I remember the complex formula that we have enacted into law now, does any of this money ever encounter use for indigent defense purposes?
Madam Chair, under current statute, fine receipts that the courts take in are split between the state general fund and the originating law enforcement agency, and that means the agency that made the arrest in the case. It never finds its way into an indigent defense fund. It goes into the state general fund, is available for general governmental purposes. It's just there's no dedicated fund right now.
Thank you, Mr. Linden.
Could I add a little rationale behind my motivation for asking for the amendment? Is that in earlier testimony it was said that they only raised this offense to a Class A traffic infraction because of their fear of the impact on the indigent defense fund. And I think that that's an important statement because we're sitting back saying there are a lot of things we'd like to do to be much harsher on people and get a hold of serious problems like driving uninsured. But because of this mammoth problem we have at indigent defense, we can't do it. So I guess what I'm saying is, well, if that is the case, then let's do something and let's begin to direct some of those funds into that program.
Madam Chair. Well, I think we should have an up and down vote on Representative Minister's motion. Let me say it very, very quickly because I know we're under extreme time pressure today.
That's right, but Representative Mason, I want to make a comment on the motion because there's been discussed as a matter of policy in terms of indigent defense whether we should dedicate a fund to pay for indigent defense of any kind, and the discussion has generally met initially with this kind of problem solving policy that Representative Minnis is raising to support the motion, but it ultimately has met with disapproval because this is a constitutionally mandated program which needs to not be shuffled off into a dedicated funding source, which then takes it out of general fund responsibility. So I'm planning on opposing the motion.
Well,
I wanted you to understand why.
Madam Chair, I think in the long run it wouldn't make any difference either way because these people are the ultimately irresponsible class. If you think you're going to get any blood out of this turnip, you're kidding yourselves. I mean, these people are the absolute, and I don't want to watch my metaphor here. These people are the absolute dregs of society, and there's just no blood in this turnip.
Madam Chair.
We've tried short of cutting their hands off.
Madam Chair, I want to make one point of response to Representative Mason's. I don't believe that that's true. There is a certain portion of those who are driving uninsured who are the dregs of society. But in my experience and practice as a police officer, I have stopped everyday ordinary people and have investigated accidents. Everyday ordinary people who you say, do you have insurance? And they look at you and say no, and they're driving a $5,000 to $10,000 car.
Got it. Discussion, clerk will call the roll on the motion.
Yes.
No.
I'll go no. I'm
sorry.
I don't think it makes any
difference. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
Calling changes to no.
No. Motion carries.
What's the vote?
What's the vote on that?
What's the vote on the motion?
4-3.
Madam Chair, let me explain what it was. I just want to move on. I don't think it's going to make one whit of difference either way. I'm sorry if I...
What was the count on that vote? How did you finally vote, Representative?
I voted no.
No, you voted yes.
I've changed to no.
Did you change to
yes,
no?
Yes, I changed
to no.
To
no. You were no.
No, I think could we run, then it failed.
Three yes.
Just a procedural question.
Yes, Representative
Miller. Gavel the vote down before everybody changed their votes. Therefore, you're going to need to have at least some kind of a motion to reconsider this thing immediately. And I don't mind. If you want to kill this thing, let's just do it.
I think Mason and I had both changed our votes prior to the gavel. She'd voted no, and he'd voted no.
She
looked perplexed.
Okay, motion fails. Let's go.
Yeah, I just want to see it moved on. And again, I don't think...
Clerk will call the roll on the
Madam
main
Chair?
Motion in front of the committee.
Madam Chair.
Senate Bill 697.
Madam Chair.
To the full committee. Representative Mannix.
I move to amend the motion on line 14 of the bill to delete the words "is involved in a motor vehicle accident at any time the person." Since we're amending the bill anyway, so that'll read, "A person who is in violation of this section is subject to suspension of the person's driving privileges under ORS 809-410. So you don't have to be in a motor vehicle accident. If the police finds out that you're driving uninsured, you could be subject to suspension.
That's a different program.
Madam Chair, let me just quickly, again, we're under extreme time pressure. We've got to get some of these bills.
Just decide whether you want to do it or not. We can vote it up or down.
Representative Mannix, it's a wonderful idea, but you're throwing grenades into the DM.
Before you came into the room, Representative Mason, I was unwilling to amend this bill. I said, let's just move it. I have a lot of things I'd love to do with it, but I wasn't going to do anything with it. We've already put one amendment on it, so it's going to have to go for concurrence anyway. So let's give them a chance to decide, well, this committee to decide whether or not you want to require that a person have a motor vehicle accident to be subject to suspension. I think any time a police officer runs across someone who's driving uninsured, they could report that and the person could be subject to suspension. It doesn't mean they will be suspended. They could be subject to it.
Move to amend your own motion?
Yes. Representative Calhoun.
Can you move to amend your own motion? An amendment to my own motion or?
Representative Calhoun, I don't think you have a motion right now.
He's asking about whether I can.
I think
you'd already motion to move.
You already had a motion on the table. I don't know that you could.
You're fine.
You get one shot and just.
Thank you. If we could, Representative Mannix, we'll take the motion that you have placed. Do this. I think it's perfectly appropriate for you to amend your own motion, Representative Mannix.